Now, the book starts getting into the nitty-gritty. This is, I think, one of the best stories I've ever written. It's certainly one of the most personally important to me. It saved my sanity. It is a fantasy of sorts, but a special kind. It is a terror of the mind, in several senses of the phrase. First, because it deals with the nightshade terrain within the thoughts. And second, because the thoughts were mine. This story grew out of a period of emotional stress after the breakup of my second marriage. I was legally separated, living alone in Los Angeles, finding it difficult to get work, and trying to run away from my own inability to cope by the senseless expedient of screwing every woman I could get my hands on. Then I began having a series of dreams. They continued for several months until, in mindless terror, I fled to the typewriter and wrote this story. When I completed it, the dreams were gone, never again to recur. There's much to be said for self-therapy. It may even be instrumental in helping someone nearing the edge to get straight once more, to rid him of, say, a lonely ache. The form of the habit she had become still drove him to one side of the bed. Despite his need for room to throw out arms, legs, in a figure four, crosswise angled body, he still slept on only one side of the big double bed. The force of memory of her body there, lying huddled on the inside, together cuddled body into body, a pair of question marks, whatever arrangement it might have been from night to night, still, her there. Now, only the memory of her warmth beside him kept him prisoner on his half. And reduced to memories and physical need for sleep, he retired to that slab of torture as seldom as possible, staying awake till tiny hours, doing meaningless things, laughing at laughers, cleaning house for himself with methodical surgical tidiness, till the pathology of it made him gibber and caper and shriek within his skull and soul, seeing movies that wandered aimlessly, hearing the vapors of night and time and existence passing by without purpose or validity, until finally, crushed by the weight of hours and decaying bodily functions, desperately needing recharge, he collapsed into the bed that he loathed, to sleep on one side only, to dream his dreams of brutality and fear. This was the dream, that same damned recurrent dream, never quite the same dream, but on the same subject, night after night, chapter after chapter of the same story, as if he had bought a book of horror stories. They would all be on one theme, but told differently. That was the way with this string of dark side visions. Tonight came number 14. A clean-cut collegiate face proudly bearing its wide, amiable grin, a face topped by a sandy brush cut and light auburn eyebrows, giving that sophomoric countenance a giggly, innocent vividness, instantly conveying friendship. Under other circumstances, Paul knew he could be close friends with this guy. Guy, that was the word he used, even in the dream, rather than fellow or man or, most accurately, assassin. In any other place than this misty nightmare, with any other intent than this one, they might have lightly punched each other's biceps in camaraderie and, hey, how the hell are you, to each other. But this was the dream, latest installment, and this college guy was number 14, latest in an endless, competent string of pleasant types sent to kill Paul. The plot of the dreams was long since formulated, now merely suggested by rote in the words and deeds of the players, sections indefinite, details muzzy, transitions blurred, logic distorted, dream style. Paul had been a member of this gang or group or bunch of guys, whatever. Now they were after him. They were intent on killing him. If they ever came at him in a group, they would succeed. But for some reason, that made sense only in the dream. They were assigned the job one by one. And as each sweet human being tried to tip him the black spot, Paul killed him. One after another, by the most detailed, violently brutal, and gut-wrenching means available, he killed the killers. 13 times they had come against him, these men who were decent and pleasant and dedicated, whom he would have been proud to call his friends under other circumstances, and 13 times he had escaped assassination. 2 or 3 or once 4 in a night, for the past several weeks, and that he had only killed 13 till now, bore witness to the frequency with which he avoided sleep entirely, or crash-slept himself into exhaustion, so there were no dreams. Yet the most disturbing part of the dreams was the brutalized combat itself, never a simple shooting or positive poisoning, never an image that could be retold when awakening without bringing a look of shock and horror to the face of Paul's confidant. Always a bizarre and minutely described affaire de mort. One of the assassins had pulled a thin, desperately sharp stiletto, and Paul had grappled with the man interminably, slashing at his flesh and the sensitive folds of skin between fingers, till the very essence, the very reality of death by knife became a gagging tremor in his sleeping body. It was as though the sense, the feel of death in progress was evoked. More than a dream, it had been a new threshold of anguish, a vital new terror which he would ever after have to support. It was something new to live with. Until finally, he had locked the man's hands about the hilt and driven the slim blade into his stomach, deep and with difficulty, feeling it puncture and gash through organs, resisting rubbery organs, then pulling it away from the mortally wounded assassin and, did he or did he suppose he had, using it again and again, till the other had fallen under the furniture. Another had been battered to his knees and dispatched finally with a smooth, heavy piece of black statuary. Still another had gone screaming, pushed abruptly, Paul with teeth bared, fang-like, vicious animal, from a ledge, twisting and plunging heavily away. The passion with which he had watched that body fall, the desire in him to feel the weight of it going down, had been the disgusting detail of that particular segment. Still another had come at Paul with some now-forgotten weapon, and Paul had used a tire chain on him, first wrapping it tightly about the assassin's neck and twisting till the links broke skin, then flaying the unconscious body till there was no life left in it. One after another, 13 of them, 2 already tonight, and now number 14, this pleasant enough guy with the rah-rah demeanor and the fireplace poker in his competent hands. The gang would never let him alone. He had run, had hidden, had tried to avoid killing them by putting himself out of reach, but they always found him. He went at the guy, wrested the poker from him, and jabbed sharply with the pike tip of it. He was about to envision where he had thrust that blunt, sharp point when the phone went off and the doorbell rang simultaneously. For a screaming instant of absolute terror, he lay there, flat on his back, the other side of the bed creased only by a small furrow made by his spastic arm as it had flung itself away from him, the other side of the bed that she had inhabited, now untenanted save for the wispy end tips of the dream, streaking away as his arm had done, while the chime and the bell rang in discordant duo. Having saved him from seeing what damage he had done the collegiate guy's face, almost like melodious saviors, rung in by a watchful god who allotted only certain amounts of fear and depravity to each sleep time. Knowing he would pick up the thread of the dream precisely where he had left off next time out. Hoping he could stave off sleep for 1 year, 2 years. So he would not have to find out how the rah-rah type had died, but knowing he would. Listening to the phone and the doorbell clanging at him, having let them serve their purposes of wakening him, now fearing to answer them. He flipped onto his stomach and reached out a hand in the darkness that did not deter him. He grabbed the receiver off its rest and yelled, "Hold it a minute, please," and in one movement flipped aside the clammy sheet, hit the floor, and surely fumbled his way to the door. He opened it as the chime went off again, and in the light from the hallway saw only a shape, no person. He heard a voice, made no sense of it, and said impatiently, come in already, for Christ's sake, and shut the door. He turned away and went back to the bed, picked up the receiver he had tossed onto the pillow, and cleared phlegm from his throat as he asked, yeah, okay now, who's this?
Paul, has Claire gotten there? Is she there yet?
He felt bits of rock salt in the corners of his eyes and fingered them tighter into the folds of flesh as he tried to place the voice. It was someone he knew, a friend. Someone.
Harry? That's you, Harry?
On the other end of the line, way out there in the night somehow, Harry Dockstader swore lightly, quickly.
Yeah, me already. Paul, is Claire there?
Paul Reed was suddenly assaulted by the overhead light going on, and he snapped his eyes shut against the blaze, opened them, closed them again, and then finally popped them open completely to see Claire Dockstader standing at the switch by the front door.
Yeah, Harry, she's here.
Then the weirdness of her being here came to him fully, and he demanded, Harry, what the hell is going on? Claire's over here. Why isn't she with you? Why is she here? It was an inane conversation, totally devoid of sense, but his synapses were not yet in focus.
Harry, he repeated.
The voice on the other end snarled, gutturally. Then Claire was coming across the room at him, wrathful and impatient, ferocious and demanding,
Give me that phone!
Each word sharply enunciated, much too fine for this hour of the morning, each syllable clear and harsh and very thin-lipped, only a woman's way.
Give me that phone, Paul. Let me talk to him. Hello? Harry? You son of a bitch, go straight to fucking hell. Die, you bastard! Ooh, you bastard!
And she literally flung the receiver onto the rest. Paul sat on the edge of the bed, feeling himself naked from the waist up, feeling the rug under his bare feet, feeling that no woman should use language like that at this hour.
Claire, what the hell is going on?
She stood trembling for a moment, valkyric in her fury, then stalked, half stumbled, fell across the room into the easy chair. Upon touching the seat, she burst into tears.
Oh, the bastard,
she repeated, not to Paul, not to the silent phone, to the air, perhaps.
That lousy chaser, that skunk in his chippies, those bums he brings up to the house. Oh, God, why'd I ever marry that skunk?
It was, of course, all laid out for Paul in that sentence, even without the particulars, even at that hour, and the ring of his own recent past was so clear, he winced. The word chaser did it. His own sister had called him that when she'd heard he and Georgette were divorcing. That damn word. Chaser. He could still hear it. It had hurt. Paul rose from bed. The 1.5 in which he managed to live, now alone, suddenly seemed close and muggy with a woman in it.
Claire, want some coffee?
She nodded, still running through her thoughts like prayer beads, eyes turned inward. He moved past her into the tiny kitchenette. The electric coffee pot was on the sideboard, and he hefted it, shook it to see if there was enough left from the last brewing. A heavy sloshing reassured him, and he plugged in the cord. As he returned to the living room, her eyes followed him. He dropped onto the bed and slid upward, bracing the pillow behind him.
Okay,
Paul said, reaching for the cigarettes beside the phone.
Lay it on me. Who was it this time, and how far along were they when you caught him?
Claire Dockstader pursed her lips so tightly, dimples appeared in her cheeks.
Only a philanderer like you, as bad as Harry, just as big a skunk, could put it that way.
Paul shrugged. He was a long, lean man with a thatch of straw-colored hair. He raked the hair off his forehead and applied himself to lighting the cigarette. He didn't want to look at her. A thing in his living room soon after Georgette, too soon, even a friend's wife. He pulled at the cigarette and at his thoughts, neither satisfied. He seemed too long for the bed, ungainly, hardly of interest to a woman, yet apparently it was not so, for she stared at him differently now. A subtle shifting of mood in the room, as though she had suddenly realized she had not only broken into his living room, but into his bedroom as well, a room in which other things than just living were done. They were very close, but held apart by a circumstance that both realized might at any moment melt. Uncomfortable, suddenly, both of them. He pulled up the sheet to his waist. She looked away. Coffee, perking, popping, distracting, thank God.
Christ, what time is it?
Paul asked, himself in self-defense more than her. He pulled the travel arm from the nightstand and stared into its face, its idiot face, as though the numbers meant something.
Jesus, Jesus, 3 a.m., Jesus, don't you people ever sleep?
He was a pot, calling a kettle black. He never slept. Never really went to bed, so who was he fooling with this line out of Suburban Rote? She shifted in the easy chair, rearranging her skirt that had ridden up over her knees, and Paul once more marveled at the joys of the current hemlines, if one was a leg man, which he had decided, with the advent of the current hemlines, he was. She caught his stare and toyed with it for a moment, then allowed it to vaporize in her own eyes, not just yet returning his proposition.
It was happening, just this easily. A pact of guilt and opportunity was being solidified, without the decency of either admitting its necessity.
Paul had been separated not nearly long enough to attempt morality of a high order, and Claire was still burning with outrage. Neither would say the name of the game, but both would play, and both knew it would happen. And as soon as Paul Reed admitted that his loneliness, his guilt, and his desires were compounding to produce, why fool around? Name it! Adultery. An act of love performed without the catalyst of love. Something unpleasant began to happen in the empty, dark, far corner of the room. He was unaware of its beginnings.
"Why did you pick me for your flight?"
he asked flippantly.
"You were the only one I could think of who'd be awake this late, and I wasn't thinking too clearly. I was too furious to think straight."
She stopped talking. She had said much more than what she had said. Of all the places she might have gone, of all the seedy bars where she might have been picked up and laid in retaliation, of all the married friends she and Harry had accrued, of all the cheap hotels where an innocent night of sleep might be purchased for $8, she had picked Paul and his living room that was a bedroom that was a hole in the world where guilt could be born out of frustration and pain.
"Is that, coffee ready?"
she asked. He slid out of bed, nakedly aware of her eyes on his body, and went into the kitchenette. He ached in places he didn't want to ache, and knew what was going to happen for all the wrong reasons, and knew he would despise not only her and himself when it had been done, when they had killed something between them, but that he would barely think of it again. He was wrong. When he handed her the coffee cup, their hands touched, and their eyes locked for the first time in this new way, and the cyclic movement began for the millionth time that night. And once begun, the cycle could not be impeded. While slowly, steadily, in the dark corner, what had begun to happen, nasty as it was, went on unnoticed. Their insensate passion, a midwife at that strange birth. Simply the mechanics of divorce were grist mill enough to powder him into the finest ash. simply the little pains of walking through the apartment where they had bumped into one another constantly, the lawyer talks, the serving of the papers, the phone calls that lacked any slightest tinge of communication, the recriminations, and worst of all, the steadily deteriorating knowledge that somehow what had gone wrong was not real, but a matter of thoughts, attitudes, dreams, ghosts, vapors. All insubstantial, but so omnipresent, so real, they had broken up his marriage with Georgette. As if they were substantial, rock hard, real, physically tearing her from his arms and his thoughts and his life. Phantom raiders from both of their minds, whose sole purpose in life was to shrivel and shred and shatter their union. But the thoughts and vapors and gray images persisted, and he existed alone in the 1.5 where they had set up their gestalt, while she cast the runes and murmured the incantations and boiled up the mystic brews, all set down so precisely in the grimoire of divorce. And as the pattern of separation progressed, a boulder racing mindlessly downhill, needing only the most impossible strength imaginable to halt its crushing rush, his life set itself up in a new sequence apart from her, yet totally motivated by her existence and the reality of her absence. Earlier that day, he'd received a phone call from her, one of those backbiting, bitter, flame-colored conversations that ended in him telling her to go to hell. She wasn't getting any more money out of him till the settlement, and he didn't give a damn how badly she needed it. The court said $125 a month, separate maintenance, and that's all you're getting. Stop buying clothes, and you'll have enough to live on. Chittering reply from the other end. $125, baby. That's it. You're the one who moved out, not me. Don't expect me to support your nutty behavior gratis. We're through, Georgette. Get that through your platinum head. We're all done. I've had it with you. I'm fed up with all the dirty dishes in the sink and your Subway phobia and not being able to touch your goddamn hair after you've been to the beauty parlor and... Oh, crap. Why bother with all this? The answer is... Chittering interruption. Vitriol electrically transmitted. Hatred telephonically magnified. Poured directly into his mind through his ear. Yeah? Well, the same to you, you stupid, simple-ass broad. The same double to you. Go to hell. You're not getting any more money out of me till the settlement, and I don't give a damn how badly you need it. He had slammed the receiver back on the stand and continued getting dressed for his date. When he had picked up the girl, a brunette he had met in his insurance agent's office, a secretary there, it was as though he was collecting unemployment, getting something to which he was entitled, but that nonetheless smacked faintly of being on relief. Picking up this girl for the first time was precisely like collecting unemployment. Enough to keep him going, but not nearly enough to sustain him in a supportable life. A dole, a pittance, but desperately necessary. A casual girl with a life of her own, whose path would cross his this once, and then they would stumble past, down their own separate roads, forever, light-footed, unlighted, interminably. "I'm afraid I won't be very charming company tonight," he told her as she slid into the car. "A woman who looks very much like you gave me considerable heartache today." "Oh?" she inquired guardedly. It was their first date. "Who would that be?" "My ex-wife," he said, telling her the first lie. He had not looked at her, save when he reached across to open the door. Now he stared dead straight ahead as he pulled the unpolished Ford away from the curb and swung it into traffic. She sat, looking at him speculatively, wondering if accepting a dinner date with an office client was such a good idea after all, no matter how engaging a sense of humor he had. His face was not at all the youthful cleverness he had presented to her on those three occasions when he had come to the insurance office. It was a harder substance, somehow, as though whatever light, frothy matter had been its basic component previously had congealed, like week-old gravy. He was unhappy and disturbed, of course, there was that in abundance, But something else skittered on the edge of his expression, a somnolence, and she was strangely frightened by it, though she was certain it meant harm not for her, but on the contrary, very much for him.
"Why do you let her give you heartache?" she asked.
"Because I still love her, I suppose," he answered, a bit too quickly, as though he had rehearsed it.
"Does she love you?"
"Yeah, I guess she does." He paused, then added in a contemplative monotone, "Yeah, I'm quite certain she does. Otherwise, we wouldn't try to kill each other so hard. It's making us both very sick, her loving me." She straightened her skirt and tried to find another passage through the conversation, but all she could think was, "I should have told him I was busy tonight." "Do I look very much like her?" He stared straight ahead, handling the wheel casually, as though very certain, very sure of it, as though he derived a deep inner satisfaction from driving, from propelling all this weight and metal precisely as he wished. It was as though he was with her, yet very far away, locked in an embrace with his vehicle. "Oh, not really, I suppose. She's blonde, you're brunette. Just around the temples, maybe, and your hair, the way you wear it, pulled back on the side that way, and the skin around her eyes crinkles the same way. That, and the tone of your skin, something like that. More reminds me of her than any actual lookalike."
"Is that why you asked me out?"
He thought about it a moment, pressing his full lips together, then replied, "No, that wasn't it. In fact, when I realized that you reminded me of her, I wanted to call the office and break the date."
"I wish you had," she thought, severely. "I wish I weren't here with you." "We don't have to go, you know."
He turned his head then, seemingly startled. "What? Oh, say, hell, I didn't mean to depress you. This thing has been going on for months. It's just one of those miserable problems that has to work itself out. Don't think I was trying to wriggle out of buying you a meal."
"I didn't think that," she replied coolly. "I merely thought you might want to be alone this evening."
He smiled, a strained little smile that was half frown and part sneer, and moved his head slightly. "Christ, anything but that. Not alone. Not tonight." She settled back against the vinyl seat cover, determined suddenly to make him uncomfortable in defense. What seemed to each of them like elastic hours stretched past, and then he said in an altogether new tone of voice, a forced, light tone, each knew was false, "Where would you like to go? Chinese? Italian? I know a nice little Armenian restaurant." She was silent, purposefully, and it served its purpose. He was uncomfortable, unhappier than before, and in the next instant it passed, and he felt hateful. Outright nasty, wanting either to get her into bed at once or to dump her, but not have to suffer this way through an entire evening. And so she defeated herself as the rock wall slid up to cover the gentleness he would have demonstrated later that night. Deviousness replaced gentleness, sadness. "Listen," he said smoothly. Once again, a new tone, a lacquer-finished tone, chromed and slick, lightly. "I didn't get a chance to shave before I picked you up, and I feel like a slob. You mind if we stop off for a minute at my place, and I'll run a razor over my face?" She was not fooled. She had been married once, had been divorced, had been dating since she was 15. She knew exactly what he was saying. He was offering a private demonstration of his etchings. Her mind turned the offer slowly, examining it in that breathless eternity of a moment in which all decisions are made, and studying each shimmering facet. She knew it was a bad idea, had no merit in any way, that she was a fool to think seriously of it, and that he would back off if she made the slightest sound of disapproval. True, a bad idea, one to reject on the spot, and she rejected it. "All right," she said. He turned sharply at the next corner. He looked down at her face, and abruptly saw her at the age of 65. He knew with a crystal certainty what she would look like when she was old. Superimposed over the pale and pink firm immediacy of her face framed against the pillow, he saw a gray line mask of the old woman she would one day become, the mouth with its stitch lines, tiny pickets running down into the lips, the dusty hollows lurking beneath the eyes, dark spaces in the character lines and in the planes of expression, as though whole sections had been sold off to retain life even at the cost of losing appearance. The sooty patina covering the flesh, much like that left when a moth has been crushed, the powdery fine ash of its wings imprinting the surface on which the death had occurred. He stared down at her, seeing the double image, the future, lying inchoate across her now face, turning the paramour beneath him into a relic of incognito spare parts and empty passions. A dim, drenched cobweb of probability, there in the eye sockets, across the mouth he had kissed, radiating out from the nostrils and pulsing ever so faintly in the hollow of her throat. Then the vision melted off her young face, and he was looking at the creature of empty purposes he had just used. There was a mad, insane light flickering out of her eyes. "Tell me you love me, even if you don't mean it," she murmured huskily. There was a hungry urgency, a breathless demand in her voice, and a fist closed around his heart as she spoke. A chill ruined his aplomb, his grasp of the present so recently returned to him. He wanted to pull out of her, away from her, as far as he could and crouch down somewhere in the bedroom in a patient, fetal security. But the corner of the room he might have chosen was already occupied. Darkly occupied by bulk and a sinister presence. The breathing in that corner was coming laboredly, but much more regularly than before. It seemed to have become more steady, pulsing, as they had entered the apartment. And during the parry and counter and riposte of their encounter, it had metronomically hurried itself to a level of even oftenness. Oh, it was taking form, form, form. Paul sensed it, but discounted the instinct. Deep breathing, stentorian, labored, but becoming more regular. Tell me you love me 19 times, very fast. "I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you," he began rattling them off, propped on one elbow, counting them on the fingers of his left hand. "I love you, I love you, I love—" "Why are you counting them?" she demanded coquettishly in a bizarre, grotesque parody of naivete. "I don't want to lose track," he answered brutally. Then he slipped sidewise, falling onto his back on Georgette's side of the bed, feeling uncomfortable there as though the ridges and whorls of her body were imprinted there, making it lumpy for him, but with the determination not to let this girl lie on that side. "Go to sleep," he instructed her. "I don't want to go to sleep." "Then go bang your goddamn head against the wall," he snapped. Then he was forcing himself to sleep. Eyes closed, knowing how angry the girl beside him had become, he commanded sleep to come, and timorously, fawn-like, in a deep foreboding forest, it came and touched him, so that he began to dream again. That dream again. In the eye, the right eye, the point of the poker entered, did its damage, came away foul. Paul flung himself violently from the sight, even as the crew-cut young man toppled soddenly past him, still alive somehow, crawling, dying by every bit of flesh through every rotting second. Starlight and darkness slipped by overhead as Paul whirled, spun, found himself in another place. A plaza, perhaps. A crowd down the smart, sleek, shop-bordered street, a posh street, where? In Beverly Hills, perhaps, glistening and elegant, and seeming almost dazzlingly clean with rhodium-finished permanence, growling, coming toward him. They were masked, caricatured, made up for some weird Mardi Gras or costume party or gathering of witches where real faces would reveal real persons and thus provide a grasp for their damnation. Strangers, boiling, hurling, sweeping down the street toward him in a chiaroscuro montage of chimerical madness. A vision out of Bosch, a bit of underdone potato or undigested Dali hurled forth from a dream image by Hogarth, a pantomime out of the innermost circle of Dante's Inferno, coming for him. For him. At last, after all these weeks, the dream had broken its pattern, and the masked terrors were now coming for him in a body, no longer one at a time, man for man, in that never-ending succession of pleasant assassins. Now they had gathered together, grotesque creatures, masked and hungry. "If I can figure out what this means, I'll know," he thought suddenly. In the midst of the multicolored haze of the dream, he knew abruptly, certainly, that if he could just make some sense from the events unreeling behind his eyes, and he knew it was a dream, right then, there would be a key to his problems, a solution that would work for him. So he concentrated. "If I can just understand who they are, what they're doing here, what they want from me, why they won't let me escape, why they're chasing me, what it takes to placate them, to get away from them, who I am, who I am, who I am, then I'll be free. I'll be whole again. This will be over. This will end. It'll end." He ran down the street, the white, clean street, and dodged in and among the cars that had suddenly appeared in lines, waiting for the light to change. He ran down the street to the intersection and cut across among the slowly moving vehicles, terror clogging his throat, his legs aching from the running, seeking an escape, an exit, any exit, a place of rest, of security where he could close the door and know they could not get in.
"Here, we'll help you,"
a man shouted from a car, where he was packed in with his family, many children. Paul ran to the car, and the man opened his door, and Paul managed to crowd past him as he pulled the seat forward, offering entrance to the back seat. Paul squeezed through, pushing the man up against the steering wheel. Then the seat was dropped back. Paul was in the rear with the children, and the car was piled with, what? Fuzzy, indistinct clothes or soft possessions that the children sat on, and he was forced to lie down across the back deck under the rear window. How could that be? He was a full-grown man. He couldn't squeeze himself into that small a space the way he had when he had been a child and gone on trips with his mother and father and laid down under the back window because the back seat was filled up the way it had been when his father had died and he had gone away with his mother from their home to the new home. Why did that memory suddenly come through so lucidly? Was he a grown man or a small child? Please answer. And he could see out the back window and the crowd of terrifying masked figures, bright-eyed and haunting, were being left behind. Still, somehow, he did not feel safe. He was with the ones who could help. That man driving, he was strong and would drive fast enough through the traffic and save Paul from the haunters. But why didn't he feel safe? Why? He woke, crying. The girl was gone. There was one who chewed gum while they did it, an adolescent with oily thighs who had no idea of how to live in her body. The act was sodden and slow and entirely derelict in its duties. Afterward, he thought of her as a figment of his imagination, leaving only her laugh behind. She had a laugh that sounded like pea pods snapping open. He had met her at a party, and her attractiveness stemmed chiefly from too many vodka and tonics. Another one was completely lovely, and yet she was the sort of woman who gave the impression, upon entering a room, of having just left it. One was small and slight and shrieked for no reason save that she had read How Passionate Women Screamed at the Climax in a bad book, or, more aptly, an undistinguished book, for she was an undistinguished woman. One after another they came to that 1.5, casual adulteries without purpose or direction, and he indulged himself again and again, finally realizing by what was taking shape in the corner what he was doing to himself and his life that was no longer a life. Genesis refers to sin that coucheth at the door or croucheth at the door, and so this was no new thing, but old, so very old as the senseless acts that had given it birth, and the madness that was causing it to mature, and the guilty sorrow, the lonely ache, that would inevitably cause it to devour itself and all within its sight. On the night that he actually paid for love, the night he physically reached into his wallet and took out $2 $10 bills and gave them to the girl, the creature took full and final shape. This girl, when good girls talk about tramps, they mean this girl and her sisters. But there are no such things as tramps, and even the criminal never thinks of himself in those terms. Working girl, entrepreneur, renderer of services, smarty, someone just getting along. These are the ways of her thoughts. She has a family, and she has a past, and she has a face, as well as a place of sex. But commercialism is the last sinkhole of love, and when it is reached by paths of desperation and paths of cruel, misused emotions, all hope is gone. There is no return, save by miracles, and there are no more miracles for the common among common men. As he handed her the money, wondering why in God's name, why, the beast in the corner by the linen closet took its final shape. And substantiality, reality was its future. It had been called up by a series of contemporary incantations, conjured by the sounds of passion and the stink of despair. The girl snapped her bra, covered herself with Dacron and decorum, and left Paul sitting stunned, inarticulate, with terror in the presence of his new roommate. It stared at him, and though he tried to avert his eyes, screams were useless. He stared back. "Georgette," he said huskily into the mouthpiece, listen to me, will you, for Christ's sake. Stop blabbering for a second, will you? Just shut up for one goddamn second, will you?" She finally subsided, and his words, no longer forced to slip themselves piecemeal between hers, left standing naked and alone with nothing but silence confronting them, ducked back within him, shy and trembly. "Well, go on," he said reflexively. She said she had nothing further to say. What was he calling her for? She had to get ready to go out. "Georgette, I've got this problem, and I had to talk to someone. You were the one I figured would understand. You see, she said she didn't know an abortionist, and if he had knocked up one of his bummy girls, he could use a goddamn coat hanger, a rusty coat hanger, for all she cared. No, you stupid ass. That isn't anything like what I'm scared about. That isn't it. And who the hell do you care who I date, you tramp? You're out on the turf enough for both of us." And he stopped. This was how all their arguments had started, from subject to subject, like mountain goats from rock to rock, forgetting the original discussion, veering off to rip and tear with their teeth at each other's trivialities. "Georgette, please, listen to me. There's a thing, some kind of thing living here in the apartment." She thought he was crazy. What did he mean? I don't know what it is. Was it like a spider or a cat or what? "It's like a bear, Georgette, only it's something else. I don't know what. It doesn't say anything, just stares at me." What was he, cracking up or something? Bears don't talk except the ones on TV. And what was he, trying to pull off a nut stunt so he wouldn't have to pony up the payments the court set? And why was he calling her in the first place, closing with, "I think you're flipping, Paul. I always said you were a whack, and now you're proving it." Then the phone clicked, and he was alone. Together. He looked at it from the corner of his eye as he lit a cigarette. Hunkered down in the far corner of the room near the linen closet, the huge, soft, brown, furry thing that had come to watch him, sat silently, paws folded across its massive chest. Like some great Kodiak bear, yet totally unlike it in shape, the truncated triangle of its bloated form could not be avoided by glance or thought. The wild, mad golden discs of its eyes never turned, never flickered while it watched him. This description, forget it. The creature was nothing like that, not a thing like that at all. And he could sense the reproach. Even when he had locked himself in the bathroom, he sat on the edge of the tub and ran the hot water till steam had obscured the cabinet mirror over the sink, and he could no longer see his own face, the insane light in his eyes so familiar, so similar to the blind stares of the creature in the other room. His thoughts flowed, ran, lava-like, then congealed, at which point he realized he had never seen the faces of any of the women who had been in the apartment, not one of them. Faceless, all of them, not even Georgette's face came to him. None of them. They were all without expression or recall. He had been to seed with so many angular corpses. The sickness welled up in him, and he knew he had to get out of there, out of the apartment, away from the creature in the corner. He bolted from the bathroom, gained the front door without breaking stride, caroming off the walls, and was lying back against the closed slab of hardwood, dragging in painful gouts of air before he realized that he could not get away that easily. It would be waiting for him when he got back, whenever he got back. But he went. There was a bar where they played nothing but Sinatra records, and he absorbed as much maudlin sorrow and self-pity as he could, finally tumbling from the place when the strings and the voice oozed forth. How I wish I could forget those happy yesteryears that have left a rosary of tears. There was another place, a beach, perhaps, where he stood on the sand, silent within himself as the gulls wheeled and gibbered across the black sky, cree, 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 driving him a little more mad. And he dug his naked hands into the sand, hurling great clots of the grainy darkness over his head, trying to kill those rotten, screaming harridans. And another place, where there were lights that said things, all manner of unintelligible things, neon things, dirty remarks, and he could not read any of them. In one place, he was certain he saw the masked revelers from his dream, and, frothing, he fled quickly. When he returned, finally, to the apartment, the girl with him swore she wasn't a telescope, but yeah, sure, she'd look at what he had to show her, and she'd tell him what it was. So, trusting her because she'd said it, he turned the key in the door and opened it. He reached around the jamb and turned on the light. Yeah, yeah, there he was. There he was, that thing, there he was, all right. Uh-huh, there he is. The thing with the staring eyes, there he is. Well? He asked her, almost proudly, pointing. Well, what? She replied. Well, what about him?
Who?
Him, you stupid bitch. Him, right there, him.
You know, I think you're out of your mind, Sid.
My name's not Sid, and don't tell me you don't see him, you lying son of a bitch.
Say, listen. You said you was Sid, and Sid you're gonna be, and I don't see no goddamn nobody there. And if you want to get laid, all right, and if you don't, just say so, and we'll have another drink, and that'll be that.
He screamed at her, clawing at her face, thrusting her out the door. Get out! Get out of here! Go on, get out! And she was gone, and he was alone again with the creature, who was unperturbed by it all, who sat implacably, softly, waiting for the last tick of time to detach itself and fly free from the fabric of sanity. They trembled there together in nervous symbiosis, each deriving something from the other. He was covered with a thin film of horror and despair, a terrible lonely ache that twisted like smoke, thick and black within him. The creature giving love, and he reaping heartache, loneliness. He was alone in that room, the two of them. Himself and that soft brown staring menace, the manifestation of his misery. And he knew, suddenly, what the dream meant. He knew and kept it to himself. For the meaning of dreams is for the men who dream them, never to be shared, never to be known. He knew who the men in the dreams were, and he knew now why none of them had ever been killed by simple gun. He knew, diving into the clothes closet, finding the duffel bag full of old army clothes, finding the chunk of steel that lay at the bottom of that bag. He knew who he was. He knew gloriously, jubilantly, and he knew it all, who the creature was and who Georgette was and the faces of all the women in the damned world and all the men in the damned dreams and the identity of the man who had been driving the car who had saved him. And that was the key, and he had it all right there, right in his hands, ready to be understood. He went into the bathroom. He was not going to let that bastard in the corner see him succeed. He was going to savor it himself. In the mirror, he now saw himself again. He saw the face, and it was a good face and a very composed face, and he stared back at himself, smiling, saying very softly, "Why did you have to go away?" Then he raised the chunk of steel. "Nobody, absolutely nobody," he said, holding the huge 45 up to his face, "has the guts to shoot himself through the eye." He laid the hollow bore of the great blocky weapon against his closed eyelid and continued speaking, still softly. "Through the head, yeah, sure, anybody. Or the guys with balls can point it up through the mouth, but through the eye? Nobody. But nobody." Then he pulled the trigger just as they had taught him in the army. Smoothly, evenly, in one movement. From the other room came the murmur of breathing, heavily, stentoriously, evenly.